Welcome back to Radio EcoShock.
I'm Alex Smith with an exposé on the threat that never makes the news, heating oceans. This is Radio EcoShock with Dr. Alistair Hobday from Australia. And we hear very little about what's going on in the Southern Ocean, especially as we get down around Antarctica. Can you tell us about some of the changes that you've heard of there?
Around the Antarctic Peninsula, which is the connection to Antarctica, that if you followed North America through South America to the Antarctic continent, that little finger of land there is experiencing very rapid atmospheric warming. As a result of that, we're seeing melting ice, declining glaciers in terms of how far they penetrate into the ocean, and that's having impacts on biology in those areas that I read about in the literature, but my team doesn't work directly in that area. Below the Australian waters, the Antarctic continent there is seeing increased carbon dioxide levels in the ocean, which means lower pH, and that's affecting the growth rate of some phytoplankton species. You know, the effects of global warming are both on temperature and in the ocean. It's on the effect of actually dissolving carbon dioxide in the ocean, which changes the pH. So we get a very double whammy effect in the ocean.
And what about the coral? I admit I'm a little bit ignorant about how ocean heating might affect the coral. Is it happening? Does it affect the coral?
Yeah, the main effect on the coral is through a process called coral bleaching. When the temperature gets above a critical threshold, and in some of our Australian waters that's above, say, 31 or 32 degrees Celsius, the coral tends to lose its symbiotic bacteria that it uses for photosynthesis. And that expelling of that bacteria from the coral tissues kind of turns them a whitey colour, and that's why it's called coral bleaching. Once they've excluded that bacteria, they're not able to function, and the coral can die afterwards. So this coral bleaching has become much more common since the 1980s, and it's very well correlated with increasing ocean temperature. So the warming ocean makes the coral more susceptible to this bleaching, and therefore the coral habitat can degrade after that. If temperatures continue to warm, bleaching becomes more and more frequent, and the coral has no opportunity to recover between these warm water events each summer.
And how important is that to marine life?
That will really change the structure of coral reefs as we know it. It won't mean a complete disappearance of coral, it will just change in form. So at the moment, a healthy coral reef might have only 10% algae growing on it, and the habitat will not be 90% coral. And so the mix of fishes are mainly coral fishes rather than algal fishes. However, with increased bleaching frequency, you see that kind of habitat shift from being coral dominated to being algal dominated. And there will be a shift in the biology that's found on those reefs as a result. So we'll still have reefs, they'll just look different to how we experience them today. And as with many things in climate change, it's just recognising that there'll be a change in conditions that results. It doesn't mean complete loss of systems, it means a change in them. And that's a decision we have to think about as society. Are we prepared to put up with that change system?
And what about the impacts of warming oceans on the commercial fisheries? We've got 1 billion people are dependent on marine life for their protein sources. Are we seeing changes for the commercial fishermen?
Yeah, we're seeing changes in species that commercial fishermen rely on. Again, using Australia as an example, on the East Coast, large species like tuna, marlins and swordfish, for example, are being found further south as the waters warm. So for fishermen operating out of northern ports, that might mean they have to travel further south in order to catch their fish. That can make it economically more expensive in terms of your fuel bills, the number of days you need to be at sea to catch your fish. And so the fishermen are confronted with a choice of, well, maybe we need to move to a different port so that we're closer to where these fish stocks are. So that occurs if there's a distribution change. There can be an economic penalty to the fishermen until they relocate. However, climate may also lead to changes in abundance of species. And in that case, there'll be real problems for food security in that we just won't have the same fish stocks anymore. However, it's really uncertain at the moment how commercial fish species will respond in terms of abundance. We have very few examples around Australia where we know that abundance is changing as a result of climate change.
And I realize the oceans are huge and, you know, there isn't one standard temperature. The temperatures are different all over the place. But I'm just, as a beginner, trying to grasp how much are the oceans warming? Can you give us examples of temperature changes? Is it big? Is it small? What's happening?
In the average, it sometimes seems quite small. Over the last 100 years, the average for the global ocean has been about 0.6 of a degree over that 100-year period. In places where the ocean is warming more quickly, though, in Southeast Australia or Southwest Australia, for example, the rate of warming can be a bit over 2 degrees over the past 100 years. So I guess the point of saying that is, yes, there is quite a lot of variation in the amount of heating. In some cases, it's 4 times faster than average. And then, of course, there'll be places in the ocean where the warming is much less than average. I think people who are sceptical about climate change will often say, well, in my region of the ocean, we're not observing any change at all. Therefore, I don't believe in climate change. However, you have to look at the whole picture and recognise that the average overall is increasing, in some spots faster than others. And it's quite easy to explain why it is not warming quickly in some areas. For example, if you have a water mass that's next to land, you know that in the afternoon when the land heats up, you can have a sea breeze. And that means the wind is blowing from the ocean onto land as the hot air over land rises. That wind blowing onto land can lead to mixing in the coastal ocean. And that mixing brings cold water to the surface. So that ocean next to the land may in fact look like it's getting cooler as the winds get stronger. So we have increasing winds as a result of climate change actually leading to cooling in the adjacent ocean. And that can complicate the picture.
And a lot of our excess heat as the climate warms is going into the oceans, but isn't there going to be a point where the oceans become, instead of a heat sink, a heat emitter? Isn't that the projection of the climate science?
As the heat goes into the atmosphere, it is absorbed by the ocean, and it will take some 30 to 60 years for that carbon dioxide that we're putting into the ocean now to be fully absorbed. In the case of the heat, it can be some 400 or 500 years before the heat basically balances out. So the ocean is very slow to catch up. However, the heat capacity of the ocean is such that it could continue to store all of the heat that goes into the atmosphere. It would just be 400 or 500 years behind that in terms of catching up.
So we may be changing the climate half a millennia away.
In terms of the carbon dioxide that's going into the ocean, that's already changed the chemistry of the ocean, and we haven't seen the kind of pH levels for something over 800,000 years, possibly, you know, even out to millions of years. So the pH is really changing, and it won't return to normal for thousands of years, even if we shut off carbon dioxide levels today. Some level of persistent change is inevitable. The challenge now for countries around the world is how to reduce those carbon emissions and minimize the damage that we're going to see.
This is Radio EcoShock with Dr. Alistair Hobday from Australia. I want to say we have a lot of podcast listeners in Australia, but our biggest audience is in the Northern Hemisphere, and we don't get a lot of news from down under. Could you pick out a few key science stories regarding this subject that you might have noticed?
One really neat example is how turtles are being affected by warming oceans and warming atmospheric temperatures. As your listeners may know, turtles nest on sandy beaches, and the temperature of the beach determines whether or not the eggs are male or female when they hatch. As you increase the temperature of the beach, and this is happening as a result of global warming, you can shift the sex ratio so that mostly the eggs hatch as females. If you continue to rise temperatures, in fact, we'll end up with populations of turtles that are completely female. One strategy that might be used to mitigate that is that, for example, if the nesting beach has a dark-coloured sand on it that is heating up more rapidly, you could actually replace that sand with a cooler, lighter-coloured sand surface and try and preserve the ratio of males to females. Other things that people are doing are planting trees at the back of beaches so that they receive shade in the afternoon and don't heat up as much. If all of those things fail to preserve sex ratios, you may have to relocate eggs from turtles that are on very hot beaches and move them to a location that's actually cooler.
Wow.
Please,
give me another example.
Other examples are with seabirds, like little penguins, which nest in southeast Australia. They nest in artificial burrows in some places, which have been put in place to replace habitat loss. As air temperatures rise, those burrows are becoming quite a bit hotter during the summer. And we've seen evidence of birds actually dying when temperatures get above 40 degrees Celsius, which is about 100 degrees Fahrenheit. Adaptation strategies for those birds include putting shade cloth over the top of the nesting areas. And you might even consider doing things like refrigerating burrows, for example, in the extreme case, to allow them to survive those very hot periods. So in the research we're doing, we're not only identifying what the impacts are on the animals or the fish or the birds, but trying to think about, given that impact, what's the adaptation strategy that we can implement to help them cope? And in terms of managing climate change, mitigation is what we're doing at a global level, trying to reduce greenhouse gases. But because that mitigation will take time, in the meantime, you have to put in place these adaptation strategies. And a lot of effort is going on in Australia and elsewhere into developing sensible adaptation strategies to help animals and even people survive in the face of a changing climate.
It almost sounds like nature is going to need human help just to survive the time until we can get our act together, let's say.
Yeah, for some species, they will definitely need intervention. And this is where adaptation can become very tricky in deciding which species need intervention and which ones you can actually afford to do it for. You know, I think it would be a very poor choice if we as a society decided, let's do adaptation everywhere, because we just simply don't know enough to manipulate the systems and help every single species of animal. You know, in the case of fishes, there are some 20,000 species of fish around the world. We can't do an adaptation strategy for all of those fish. So it will be picking particular ones that might be valuable to humans or are particularly threatened, like seabirds or marine mammals or turtles, and choosing to intervene to help those. And the adaptation strategy should really try and give them just some extra time. The rate of climate change that we're seeing at the moment is just much, much faster than anything these species have experienced in, you know, millions of years. So if we can give them just a bit more time, maybe they will be able to adapt on their own. And so many of the strategies that we're thinking about are just trying to slow down the effect of the climate change that these animals experience and give them that extra time to adapt on their own.
Have you seen projections of how much the ocean could warm this century?
Yes, the IPCC is perhaps the world authority on issuing those projections. And depending on how much carbon dioxide is put into the atmosphere in the coming decades, we'll see warming of about 1.8 to about 5.5 degrees of temperature in the ocean.
In the ocean, I thought that applied to the land base, but we could get up to 5 degrees C change in the ocean in this century, they're saying?
Yeah, that's right. In some of the hot spots around Australia, for example, or even there are other ones off Japan or the northeast coast of the US, we're expecting, if carbon dioxide emissions continue to rise, that we'll see temperatures increasing up to those levels. And that's for more open ocean environments. In inland seas, the heating could be quite a bit warmer. So, for example, enclosed bays, Sea of Cortez, parts of the Mediterranean could warm up much more dramatically than that. Anywhere where you've got a very shallow water mass or water body, the atmospheric temperatures have a lot more influence.
And I've heard some scientists, including Dr. Peter Ward, suggest that we could even see a change in the sea life to an extreme event, perhaps because also of the acidification. And so, you know, how bad a scenario is this if we just let it all roll on and burn all the fossil fuels we've got? What happens to warming oceans?
It means things will be very different than they are today. That said, terrestrial landscapes are very different today to what they were 100 or 200 years ago. We've modified our landscapes in a really big way. We put in farms, we do clear felling, all kinds of agricultural practices are changing the land. So in essence, changes to the ocean might just look like changes on land. However, that change can be very difficult to cope with. So the risk for humanity is that the changes are such that we are not actually able to adapt to it. That's in a practical sense. In just a biodiversity sense, those changes will mean that some species are not able to adapt and they may go extinct. And as you would know, this kind of climate change has been referred to as the, you know, the sixth great mass extinction. And in this case, it will be caused by humans. However, our evidence for claiming that, I think, is a bit weaker at the moment. So I'm definitely not an alarmist about that. I would just make the point that climate change will change the ocean as we know it today. And it may change it in ways that we wish had not happened.
What have I missed, Dr. Hobday? Is there something you'd like to add as we wrap up for our listeners?
Climate change is not coming in the future. We've got evidence that the climate has been changing very dramatically over the past 40 years already. We've seen that in responses of fishes, of birds, of mammals, of reptiles. And so the idea that we can just defer our decision-making because climate change is something that's coming in the future is not the case. It's really disappointing that many of the actions of today's generation are deferring decisions to our children or to our grandchildren. And I think they'll look back at us and think, you guys knew about climate change back in the year 2011. You deferred the choice to do anything about it onto us. And I think that's a really lazy decision. And so I don't think we'll be viewed very favourably by our children and grandchildren unless we take a bit more action than we're currently doing. And I definitely am not in a position where I want to disappoint my children. So that's in part that motivates my behaviour change.
Me too. From Australia, our guest is from the top Australian scientific organization, CSIRO, Dr. Alistair Hobday. Thank you so much for spending time with us.
Hey, great to talk with you, Alex. Thank you.
Next on Radio EcoShock, we're going to catch the wave of startling and disturbing science news coming out of the last couple of weeks. The signs are everywhere. We have passed the climate tipping point. The melting permafrost, hotspots seen by satellite, scientists and governments are wildly underestimating our current situation. A lot of that is captured by a new multimedia climate show called The Climate Show. What else? The radio show comes out of New Zealand, originating at Kiwi FM in Auckland. There are three great hosts. Glenn Williams runs a New Zealand breakfast show, Radio Whammo. Glenn is a techie who hooks up radio, television, and the internet. The Climate Show is available on YouTube as well. A second regular host is John Cook, blogger extraordinaire at Skeptical Science. Our sample is from Climate Show number 8, where the guest is another New Zealand-born scientist, Dr. Kevin Trenberth, head of the Climate Analysis Section at the USA National Center for Atmospheric Research in Colorado. In the program, Trenberth, who was one of the targets of the infamous ClimateGate attacks and a lead IPCC author, describes the increased precipitation, floods, and even snowstorms developing in this heating world. A prestigious guest. Dr. Trenberth happened to be in Christchurch, New Zealand, on the very day of that big earthquake there. He was shaken up but unhurt. In today's Radio EcoShock program, we're going to hear a summary of Bloody Depressing Science, as it said, from the third host, another Kiwi, author and super researcher Gareth Renowden. He's the author of Hot Topic, Global Warming and the Future of New Zealand, and blogs at hot-topic.co.nz.
Hello and welcome along to The Climate Show. It's episode number 8. Nice to have you along. My name is Glenn Williams, broadcasting from the Kiwi FM studios in Auckland City. My co-host cannot be possible without him. Of course, it's Gareth Renowden in North Canterbury in Waipara. Hello to you, Gareth.
Hi, Glenn. How are you?
I'm pretty good. I tell you what, I'm not as shaken as you guys have been in the past week.
I wanted to move on to this week's great graphic. It's from NASA's Earth Observatory, and it was the image of the day there, February the 24th. And what it shows is the northern hemisphere of our planet, and it's material generated from satellites. And what they've looked at is how the effects of melting snow and ice have acted to warm the northern hemisphere. So, okay, when you've got snow covering the land, what it does is it tends to reflect sunlight. It's called the albedo effect. Mm. And so having snow and ice on the ground and on the sea has a cooling effect on the whole of the northern hemisphere. What they've done is they've looked at the change in that over a period of years, over the last 30 years that the satellites have been flying. And so on the left-hand side, the blue picture shows you the cooling effect of snow and ice on the ground. And then the one on the right shows you how that has changed over the last 30 years, 1979 to 2008.
Right.
And so the areas of red there are where reductions in snow and ice cover have acted to warm those areas. And it's quite marked around the Arctic Ocean, parts of the mountainous states in the US, but particularly down there over what are the Himalaya and Tibet. Mm. So you can see it's a warming effect. It's quite dramatic. And interestingly, it's much more than the models were predicting. So there's a sign of it's a positive feedback that the general warming has acted to reduce the snow and ice cover, but the reduction in the snow and ice cover is feeding back into the process and increasing the warming.
And this brings us on to the next bit of news about permafrost, and the thawing of permafrost is likely to accelerate global warming.
Yeah, absolutely. This is something that science has been aware of for some time. There is a very great deal of carbon locked up in the permafrost left behind by the...
Can you explain exactly what permafrost is?
Okay, well, permafrost is basically frozen ground. The soil contains moisture. Its temperature is below freezing, so it's ice, and it's a mixture of ice and soil. And an awful lot of this was created during the last ice age. And mixed up in all of that soil and ice are roots and vegetation, and what was the ecosystem before the last ice age is down there under the soil. Hmm. Now, as long as it stays cold, it's like a refrigerator. This stuff is effectively deep frozen in the ground. But as the permafrost melts, so the ice melts, the vegetation becomes exposed to the atmosphere and to bacteria and bugs that can get in there and start to decompose. So it becomes a food source for this microbial ecosystem. And this gives off the greenhouse gas methane. So the carbon that's locked up in these old frozen soils as they melt can get into the atmosphere. And there is a lot of it there. Now, this latest study calculates that up to 2/3 of the permafrost in the Earth around the planet, most of which is in the northern hemisphere in kind of northern Canada and Russia and Siberia, up to 2/3 could disappear over the next 200 years. And that most of this will actually happen over the next 100 years. And the amount of carbon that that will release is equivalent to half of the amount of carbon that we have managed to put into the atmosphere
wow.
since the start of the Industrial Revolution. Before we started fiddling with the atmosphere, there was about 280 parts per million of CO2. We're now at 390. So you're talking about 110 parts per million. So what they're saying is effectively there's the equivalent of another 55 or so parts per million of CO2 that will come out if this permafrost continues to melt.
The pessimist in me says that's game over, right?
Yeah, well, you've got to hope not. At the very least, it makes the job that we have to do in reducing emissions much, much harder because, you know, we've got to try and stabilize the atmosphere either at current levels, something above current levels, or something below current levels. So effectively, the stuff that comes out of the permafrost makes it harder because we've got to take that into account as well. So if, let's say, we were going to aim, as Jim Hansen wants us to do, for a target of 350 parts per million, that means, first of all, that we have to stop emitting carbon and we have to start sucking it out of the atmosphere. If the permafrost is melting and feeding back into the process, we've got to then suck all that out of the air as well.
Yeah.
So the job becomes hugely more difficult. It's the biggest positive carbon cycle feedback, to use the jargon, that we know about. And this paper really puts some quite scary numbers on the scale of the problem that we face. And what it does, if nothing else, is kind of double underline the importance of acting quickly, because if we could, the sooner we can stabilize temperatures up north and hopefully begin to get them to fall, then the smaller the impact of the melting permafrost will be. Taken together with the earlier pretty pictures of the effect of the reduction in snow and ice in the Northern Hemisphere, I have to say it's not a pretty picture, and it doesn't actually help when the next item that we're going to look at, which is a new paper by Kevin Anderson and Alison Bowes, which was published last week, they are basically saying that we have to start cutting our carbon emissions really, really soon, because where we're aiming at the moment virtually guarantees much more than the 2 degrees Celsius that the world is aiming for.
And so what they're saying is that where we're aiming at the moment is what is guiding climate change policy around the world. Are they talking about the IPCC projections?
Yeah, what they're doing is they're saying, well, look, what happens when you look at where we actually are with our emissions, and they build into their modelling that we're running ahead of IPCC scenarios. So we're looking at a situation where there's the growth in emissions is faster. And then they look at what sort of emissions profiles we might have to achieve if we really wanted a serious chance of staying under or not going far over 2 degrees Celsius. And they find that the kinds of emissions cuts that are required are up to, you know, 10% per annum, which most people who have looked at this consider to be, you know, virtually economically impossible, or at the very least only feasible if the planet decides that it will do nothing else economically other than try and get carbon out of the atmosphere. There's a very telling line in the paper, which I'll quote. It's from the discussion at the end of the paper, which incidentally is free access, so anybody can download this. It's possibly not bedtime reading, but yeah, it's pretty clear as these things go.
It's the from the Royal Society, is that right?
Yeah, it's the Royal Society in UK are publishing this.
Okay.
Basically, this sentence struck me really rather forcefully. They said, put bluntly, while the rhetoric of policy is to reduce emissions in line with avoiding dangerous climate change, most policy advice is to accept a high probability of extremely dangerous climate change rather than propose radical and immediate emissions reductions. That's why they call their paper Beyond Dangerous Climate Change, because they also, we've talked in the past about this so-called 2-degree guardrail, the target of trying to stay under 2 degrees Celsius, because it has been felt that, you know, that was the rough sort of borderline between stuff that we could cope with and stuff that we couldn't cope with.
Yeah.
What Anderson and Bowes also point out is that 2 degrees Celsius does not guarantee a lack of dangerous climate change. It becomes the borderline between dangerous climate change and extremely dangerous climate change. Mm. So they're saying that the where we're aiming, we're being ineffectual in terms of our policy at aiming for that target anyway, so we're likely to exceed it. You know, we may end up with 3 to 4 degrees Celsius of warming rather than 2 on current policy settings. But, you know, we're going to get into trouble long before we get to 2 degrees Celsius. Yeah. The emissions cuts that are actually required to get us down under 2 degrees Celsius are much larger than anyone in the policy community internationally are beginning to discuss. Mm. I brought the paper up in a recent post of mine. I made a submission to the government. The government, New Zealand government, is asking for feedback on its decision to kind of formally target a 50% reduction in New Zealand's carbon emissions by 2050. They call it their 50 by 50 target.
Yeah.
And the Anderson and Bowes paper actually kind of double underlines why a 50 in 50 target is grossly inadequate. You know, internationally, we need to be heading for, as I said, when I discussed heading for 350, we have to be looking at getting rid of our carbon emissions, heading for a zero emissions, and heading below zero emissions. I mean, to get back into safe territory where the permafrost isn't going to melt, we're going to have to get down to perhaps the 350 level, maybe even lower. And that has enormous implications for how our economies are going to be structured in 50 years' time. And whilst perhaps it doesn't seem terribly urgent at the moment, we've put in place the kind of inertia of our energy systems and the emissions that we're making make it incredibly difficult for us to do anything to try and stop it at the moment. And that's before you start talking about people who argue, you know, skeptics arguing that we should do nothing, or farmers saying they don't want to pay a fart tax or anything like that. Before you get into the politics of it, you know, the science is beginning to get really bloody depressing.
Yeah. And there's more discussion of this up at hot-topic.co.nz. There's a post there by Brian Walker titled The Road to Ruin as well. Our new website is fully up and running, and it's good to see some conversation going on there. It's theclimateshow.com, also up at hot-topic.co.nz.
That was New Zealand author Gareth Renowden, along with radio host Glenn Williams, on the new cross-media program, The Climate Show, number 8. I've got a lot of links to the science explained by Gareth, and to the radio show and its host in my Radio EcoShock program blog at ecoshock.info. Along the way, Gareth hit a really, really important idea. So far, our economy is an engine that grabs fossilized sunlight from underground and releases it into the atmosphere and the sea. To avert utter catastrophe, we have to do just the reverse. Our entire economy may become devoted to drawing down greenhouse gases. Now think about that. Not as a sideline while we keep burning fossil fuels. The new Mission One for survival? Not just the emergency shutdown of fossil fuels, that must happen. Not just the switch to renewables, yes, yes, but much more. A civilization whose technology reduces greenhouse gases before we lose the ice world and a habitable planet. If the unarmed, often poorest people in the Middle East and North Africa can stand up to tanks and fighter jets and the dictators for their freedom, surely we can at least try to save the future climate from disaster. Tweet that. And then act at your legislature, in the streets, in the schools. Wake up your neighborhood. Put down those fossil weapons. Look a child in the face without guilt. I'm Alex Smith. Find out more at our website, ecoshock.org.